It's a sign not just of the turning of the seasons, but the turning of the years when one considers that Michael Morgan first became known to many of us in Chicago 23 years ago when Sir George Schulte appointed Michael to be assistant conductor of the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. Now, there are enough people in Chicago who have known Michael even longer than 23 years because Michael went to Oberlin, the tentacles. And there are people, Michael, who just graduated from Oberlin, and there are people I know in their 80s, and they all claim they knew you from Oberlin. So you are the celebrity. We are so happy to have Michael back in Chicago anytime for any reason, but especially because he's been in town to prepare a concert with the Chicago Sinfonietta, the Chicago Sinfonietta looking at a wonderful range of people to succeed the founding artistic director, Paul Freeman, as music director of the Sinfonietta. But Michael has been doing so many interesting things, mostly out of his base in Oakland and the East Bay in California, that we wanted to talk with him about the pioneering work that he has done in orchestra building and music education, as well as just his wonderful, amazing, continually international and exciting career. Michael, welcome back to Chicago.
Oh, it's fun to be here. I was thinking the other day as I was being driven around that it feels actually like I never left. So it feels perfectly natural to be in Chicago.
You spent 5 years here?
Seven.
Seven.
Schulte's last five and Barenboim's first two.
Right. I'm wondering, just looking back, both for you as Michael Morgan, the conductor and musician, and also perhaps as somebody who has had a few chances in recent years to see and hear the CSO, if you might just reflect a little bit on then and now.
Well, I came back the week of Barenboim's final concerts and attended all of the ninth symphonies that he did as his final concerts. Because I actually grew much closer to Daniel after I left here, which isn't that always the case. But so I came back and noticed both the changes in sound and the changes in approach at the CSO, which is only natural once the conductor changes that the approach would change also. The predominance, and rightly so, of now this really wonderful string sound that the CSO gets. And then the other thing that was so amazing was he just had, Barenboim just had the greatest good fortune in terms of hiring wind principals they're just spectacular. Mm-hmm. I mean, you just couldn't wait for the next solo whatever to come out of that orchestra. So I'd have to say that as wonderful as Schulte was and as incredible as the CSO sounded during those years, that it's in a different way, but it was Barenboim, in fact, found ways to improve on the sound, mm-hmm. which mm-hmm. I don't know if I would have predicted that when he came.
It's interesting thinking back to that period of the changeover from Schulte to Barenboim. And you not only were in those 5 years of Schulte, 2 years of Barenboim, but there's a period of overlap and transition when you have a music director designate as well. So you really saw everything going. And we were all trying to find our bearings, I think, as players, as listeners, as conductors. And I remember a number of conversations we had back in that period. And I think for many people, it was not a question of Barenboim or not Barenboim. It was, how will the orchestra be now? We were all so used to a certain way of being. And one of the great things about time is it gives both an artist a chance to develop and also an audience a chance to connect in a different way with that artist.
Yes, for those of us who were, at that time, the conducting staff, it was me and Ken Jean. As I said, I actually wasn't that close to Barenboim at all when I was actually working for him. You know, I think I've talked to him about this, the fact that he was like the stepdad when he came in. He had been hired by Schulte, and then now there was a stepdad, so we just weren't as close to him. And then after I left, that I started talking to him about various things, some of his initiatives in the Middle East, and some of the things that we all so admired him for doing, and I became much closer to him then. Mm-hmm. And then I would come back and hear the CSO and how the things he was doing to the string sound, which were very, very impressive. And I knew they weren't happening by accident. Things like that don't. Right. You have to work at them over time.
Now, you've made choices as well about what you want to work on and where you want to work. When you left Chicago, you had already been doing all kinds of guest appearances, doing a lot of opera conducting, doing a lot of invited appearances around the country and around the world. But you decided that you wanted to make, at least at that time, you thought for a while, and now it's been 20 years, you wanted to do something where there would be an orchestra that was very much based in a community and an orchestra that was very much involved with the education of young people and the community at large, and that took you to what was then a new or a reformed entity, the Oakland East Bay Symphony.
Yes, it was both of my California orchestras are post-bankruptcy orchestras. So orchestra,
you do workouts.
I do orchestra turnarounds is really what the field is. But no, I went to Oakland because Oakland had all of the issues that I like to deal with. The orchestra needed building up. The community is very fractious and needs to be pulled together. And how do you do that around the mechanism of a symphony orchestra? So you have opportunities in programming. You have opportunities in getting out and into education at all, for all ages. And you also have to politically connect the orchestra into the political fabric of the community, which was always important to me. I mean, I grew up in Washington, D.C., and so the nexus between art and politics was always really important and really interesting and not something I ever shied away from. So you had all of those, you had a laboratory for all of those issues in Oakland, California, and it just seemed a natural fit. I was very happy there. Still, I'm very happy there. We still have, as I point out to people, the reason that it goes on and doesn't seem to be ending is because we still have a good time during mm-hmm. the rehearsals. We still all laugh a lot and we produce, they allow me to do things. I mean, they allow me to end, for example, a couple of seasons ago, I got to end the season with a concert performance of Follies of Stephen Sondheim. Wow. And where else am I going to get to do right. things like that? Right. I got to stage the Bernstein Mass in addition to conducting it. And I get to do things that I just don't know where else I'd get to do them. And at the same time, have this community-focused mission and this bringing people together mission and this introducing the music to the next generation So all those things together make it just as interesting a place as I could imagine working.
Let's talk about the generational issue, because I guess 20 years is considered to be a generation. And I'm curious to know, you were excited when you went out there. You started doing exciting things right away. I think you all serve something like 24,000 students and school children in the area every season.
And the idea was to figure out a balance between the sort of drive-by, you know, just the young people's concert or just a visit to a school, some balance between that at the one end and structured sequential instruction to individual children at the other end. And that meant that you actually had to go for more contact and perhaps not as large numbers of children served. Mm-hmm. But the idea was always to create to create for those children a logical progression from wherever they sat in their elementary school, public or private, and a logical path from there to the stage of the symphony as a professional mm-hmm. musician. And along the way, while you're making that path obvious, you're also showing the other children who are not interested in music that there are all of these things that you can do and be that are not necessarily what you see around you. You can be the only one that's interested in something, and it's completely valid and to be encouraged. Mm-hmm. So all of that. And now the interesting thing is, because I've been there for so long, I am stopped on the street by fully adult people who remember me coming to their third grade classroom and talking about the symphony.
Right.
So I like that.
It's, yeah. I mean, you must be getting kids of people who were kids in these
certainly.
Programs now.
Oh, certainly. And yes. And I'm always threatening to run for mayor, because now all the children that I brought up, now they can all vote. So,
have you had any people join the orchestra or the staff or any of the other components of what you do who were first exposed to music through your program?
Well, I tell you, it's not the I haven't been there that long.
Okay.
I mean, the ones that are sort of from the beginning of the time that I got there, they are. Some of them have come through major music programs. In fact, there's one here going through taking violin at Northwestern.
Wow.
And we've gotten them scholarships to various places. And so they're coming through the college age, mm-hmm. even some at the grad school level. So they aren't quite old enough that I've cycled back around and I see them now, you know, in the front office or something, because
right.
that would be kind of scary, really. So... it's horrifying enough when I see people who are fully adults and they're telling me about me visiting their third grade classroom.
Right.
I mean, how old
right.
does that make me at this point? So
we never ask our guests their age. What is the racial and ethnic makeup currently of Oakland, and what is it of the schools there?
I have to say that the what makes both Oakland and Sacramento interesting.
We should mention you're also in Sacramento.
Yes, I've been in Sacramento for 10 years, and I've been in Oakland for 20. I tend to come someplace and just kind of park. what's interesting about both communities is that there really is not an obvious predominant race in either mm-hmm. city. I mean, there are lots mm-hmm. of stories, particularly about Sacramento, how there is no majority there. Mm-hmm. And Oakland is very much the same way. There's a lot of everyone, and any public gathering is automatically a mix of.
So we're talking black, white, Hispanic, Asian, and subgroups.
Oh,
and
we did a concert 2 years ago now. We're going to do one again next year. That half the program was Persian. Mm-hmm. And because we have an enormous Persian community in the Bay Area
right.
that had not really been very much approached by any of the orchestras. And so it was we're looking at entire other segments of
right.
our community that we still haven't reached.
You're going to have an Armenian program.
We're doing an Armenian program this year. We've done Chinese. I'm moving at some point into probably next year. We will probably commission something in the way of Filipino jazz, because it's a huge...
there's a large jazz, Filipino jazz community.
There's a very large Filipino jazz community. Yes, oh, yes, it's really. I mean, well, that's the interesting thing for me about being in the Bay Area is that you are constantly learning that there are these great chunks of people who are involved in one sort of music or another, and they may or may not have any direct connections to your orchestra. And so I've relied over the years on particularly local composers who are fluent in both cultures or many mm-hmm. cultures, and I rely on them to write pieces that show both things to best advantage. Mm-hmm. That is the culture we're emphasizing at a given concert, but they also, they know how to write the traditional music for that culture. They also know how to write for symphony orchestra so that both things come off well, because it's so easy to do a program where one or the other recedes so far into the background that you don't, you perhaps don't see the parallels between them.
Thank you. We're speaking with Michael Morgan, who is music director of the Oakland East Bay Symphony. He's also artistic director of the Oakland Youth Orchestra, music director of the Sacramento Philharmonic, artistic director of Festival Opera in Walnut Creek, which is also over the hills in the East Bay of San Francisco Bay Area, and he's artistic advisor to the Peoria Symphony right here in Illinois. Of course, you all know and remember Michael as assistant conductor for 7 years of the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, where he also led the Civic Orchestra and was active in just about every aspect of musical life in Chicago.
Well, and the Chicago Youth Symphony.
And the Chicago Youth Symphony Orchestra.
Yes, that was one of my very favorite things.
And you've seen people from the Youth Symphony go on to major careers in orchestras.
Oh, both McGill brothers and Rachel Barton Pine, and these people were all in.
So when you were watching the inauguration, were you saying, I taught that guy?
Well, I always say that when I go to the Met and I see him sitting there in the clarinet, you know, his principal clarinet, you know, Anthony McGill being the principal clarinet at the Met, this is no small job.
No.
So
yeah.
So
I don't know if he'd want me to say a protege, but you had a younger conducting colleague in Rawson Milanoff who has gone on to things on the East Coast.
I have tried to help as, you know, younger conductors wherever I could and still do. In fact, I was just recommending one to the Chicago Sinfonietta just yesterday because they are still filling out some of their concerts even in these seasons while they're looking. It's very important to me to help that next generation come along because I had such great helpers when I was trying to come along.
You spend so much time, good time, working with young people, helping musicians come along, giving advice to people. And I know from people who've received your advice, it's sometimes tough. It's always good, and it's always practical as well as philosophical. But there probably are people who know you from your days with the Washington National Opera, Metropolitan Opera, Chicago Symphony, who might say, but Michael, you love Mozart, and don't you want to go back to Vienna to the State Opera and do some more operas? Don't you want to emphasize you more?
Well, okay. I look around at the standard conductor careers that some of my friends have, and many of whom make a lot more money than I do.
But I wasn't going to bring that up.
What they're doing does not appear to be that so much fun to me. I really do think it's important to be having a good time, and that whether or not you're having a good time really is reflected in the concerts that you do. I know so many people who seem to be so under the gun that their performances just do not have the spark of joy that we're supposed to have if we're going to do this. And so I try to stick with things that I personally find really rewarding, and being able to do interesting things and be involved in different aspects of the business. You know, my little opera company, I stay there because they let me stage operas in addition to conducting them.
So I
get to do stuff that's really fun for me to do.
And you don't have to live on airplanes.
I don't have to live on
airplanes. And you know the names of everybody in all of your orchestras.
I won't go that far because I'm at an age now where names are starting to disappear.
You know the faces of many of the members of your orchestra and even what instruments some of them play.
And the other thing I very much like, I was always, even back in the day, I mean, I used to talk to Henry Fogel about this fact that I just always felt, even from the beginning, that I was just so much better a music director or you know, regular conductor than I was as a guest conductor or functioning under someone, just because it inhibits me in ways that make what I do come off just not as well. So I would prefer to stay someplace where what I'm doing shows to best advantage. I feel fulfilled, and I'm getting to do make the kind of music that I'd like to make. And if that means you're less famous than some of your colleagues, that's really okay with me.
You've always had, I think, as someone who's known you off and on and watched you throughout the last quarter century, you've always had a wonderful degree of self-knowledge. And I wonder sometimes with artists, not just conductors, but performers, how many of them run into difficulties at some point in their career, and everyone will run into the difficulties fate puts up for us. But because they haven't really assessed themselves and taken note of what's right for them, their instrument, their mind, their personality, and they've sort of let managers or the way it's done drive things, and then one day they look around and the talking heads, this is not my beautiful house, you know. They wonder what hotel room they're in and what orchestra they're conducting, what piece are they playing in, where's their soul.
I talk a lot now, and when I'm giving, and I give a lot of speeches, and I love talking, so that's another thing. But you know, I give a lot of talks now, especially to young artist types, about it being really important to establish how much is enough. Once you figure out how much enough is, stop when you get there, so that you can then be happy and do what you're best suited to do, rather than constantly reaching for more and more and more. You know, more, more, more may be what you are supposed to want, but it's not what you actually want. So try to figure out what you actually want and do that. And if it doesn't look like a standard career, that's okay. There are plenty of people who are doing standard careers, and everybody is happy with them.
Mm-hmm. You have a colleague now in Southern California who is getting a lot of attention, and frankly, I think he deserves a lot of the attention he's getting. But the reason I bring up Gustavo Dudamel is not about him as a person or what people find exciting about him individually from television or whatever, but it's to make an observation, and maybe I'm wrong, that Gustavo couldn't get the support for things like this new Youth Orchestra of Los Angeles program and other ideas of the orchestra spending time with the community if there hadn't been work done and if there wasn't work going on a daily basis all around the country that started pushing other people in that direction. A lot is made of and should be made of the Sistema in Venezuela. It's nice to have a country that backs music for everybody. But there's been work like that going on town to town, city to city, but under the national mainstream media radar.
Well, it's not glamorous work. By any means, it's extremely rewarding. It's not. I certainly wish Dudamel very well. I've met him only briefly. Seems to be a very nice man, and I hope that in fact the business does not change that, because I've also known other people who wound up being a lot less nice after they had been in the field for a while. But I find what he's doing very exciting. I'm glad people are excited by it. But there are also a lot of other people just working in the trenches who are not under such a spotlight, who don't have such a platform, who are doing really fantastic work. The other thing that I hope is that he's allowed to develop, because the talent is so enormous. You hope that he will develop into, a conductor his age is not an adult. An adult conductor is at least 50 and 60. And, you know, when the conductor is 50, you at least know whether it's a real conductor or not. And the really greats, you don't hit until 60 and 70. Mm-hmm. So you just hope that people will continue to develop and not get stuck where they are, because of all the attention. It's hard to develop under that spotlight where all of your where your actual process of development, everything is being magnified. So I certainly wish him well, and there has been a lot of work that has gone into education, outreach, community engagement, as we call it now, all over the country. And I think even the most conservative, the most staid of orchestras has come to understand that if they're going to have a future, that is the model they need to embrace. It also makes, I think, things more interesting on the stage, even for the performers in the orchestra. Doing a great variety of things makes the lives of the players more interesting, and mm-hmm. then in turn makes their playing more interesting and makes the concerts that you come to see more interesting.
We all could name some really great orchestras that are really great in certain repertoire, and that we probably wouldn't even cross the street to hear play repertoire that was away from the core of that particular repertoire. Isn't it better to have an orchestra that can not, I don't want to say play anything in the way that some orchestras that spend a lot of time playing commercials or movie music to make money do, but that can play anything that's interesting and that's serious, or that at least can find itself wanting to be engaged in a variety of types of music?
I think the more flexibility you have, and American orchestras are particularly well positioned to do this because the training they've gotten is so great, and they're used to doing things on what is, by, for example, European standards, just obscenely short rehearsal time. And so they are used to being very quick, and they can do quite a variety of things. So I think it really will make the overall product, even when they go back to their repertory that they are famous for, it's going to make those performances more interesting to have done these other things. I should mention my friend Mason Bates is coming to the CSO as a composer in residence, and a lot of his music is electronically based, very. He's very much into electronica himself, but it's also very heavily beat-based, and some of the pieces. And that is something that most of the major American orchestras are frankly not that good at. That is really locking in on a really relentless fixed beat. Most orchestras have what I like to call Eurorhythm, and that is it's close and it's very malleable and it can do a lot of rubato, but the idea of rhythm actually locking in and being a physical manifestation is just not known to them. Mm-hmm. And so I've watched Mason rehearse his pieces sometimes with some pretty major orchestras and not be able to get people to just lock in on the beat. So it'll be very interesting to have him bring that act to Chicago.
I have an image of a symphony orchestra in the middle and Pierre Boulez coming at them from one end and Mason Bates coming at them from the other end saying, you all are going to learn to articulate rhythm and to lock into the beat.
Yes, exactly. It really is two sides of of a very strange coin. Yes.
Tell us about how you put a program together in general. For example, in Chicago, with the Sinfonietta, your program is Ibert, Michael Doherty's Dead Elvis, Mio, and a Mendelssohn symphony.
Well, in the case of the Sinfonietta, they wanted a program around humor, which is actually far harder to do than it sounds. To do an orchestra concert around humor and music is really very difficult because so much of what we as musicians would consider funny, if you even take something like the Mozart musical joke, which we all think is just the hoot, the general public, who perhaps is not as versed in 18th century musical conventions, finds it vaguely amusing. Maybe the wrong notes would be funny, but the actual form and structure jokes, they don't get. And so it's very hard to put together a program that's really funny. But between the Ibert Divertissement, which is very entertaining, and the Mio Le Beau sur le Toit, also a very overtly entertaining, colorful piece. And then in the middle is this Dead Elvis by Michael Doherty. And Michael Doherty is just, you know, he's insane, but it's in an ingenious way. And so his pieces are really laugh out loud funny, mm-hmm. when he wants to be. So that's he's kind of your go-to person now if you really want something that anyone will recognize as being of humorous intent. You know, if you write a piece called Le Tombeau de Liberace, clearly you're something serious is not about to happen on that stage.
Where does Mendelssohn fit in?
Mendelssohn fits in because the Chicago Sinfonietta is in a search for a new conductor, and okay. You have to do something that shows, you know your way through a piece of the standard repertory. So, you know, you can't only do Dead Elvis. You also have to be able to do something that comes why don't we just call normal, normal concert music.
Yeah. Michael Morgan not only loves to talk by his own admission, but as you hear, he's a great talker and a man who has no shortage of humor himself, but knows when and where it ought to be placed. Tell us a bit about your current work in opera, which is with a smaller company in Walnut Creek, California, but also where you stage at least some, if not all, of the operas, as well as conduct them.
I only stage the ones where I pretty much only do modern staging, because Men in Tights just don't do anything for me in terms of opera directing. And frankly, the whole Men in Tights thing is one more reason for young people to have a distance between themselves and opera. So it actually, my opera staging came from sitting through so many staging rehearsals of so many really quite wonderful directors, but watching during the staging rehearsals and going, you know, this is not brain surgery what we're doing here. You know, I could probably do this. Now, I always have a really great co-director with me,
okay,
who has a great eye for anything that I miss, you know, that's going on the stage. And as I say, I'm usually doing modern productions, but I only update things when all the characters make sense in whatever the new context.
Give us an example.
Well, the Don Giovanni, which was the first thing I ever staged with the opera company, the Don Giovanni was set in a nightclub, and it was set entirely in a nightclub, which Giovanni owned the nightclub, Leporello ran the nightclub, Mazzetto was the bartender, Zerlina was a waitress, you know, and the rest of the people were club kids coming and going. Commendatore was the bouncer. You know, everybody made sense in the context of a bar. So they had ways of behaving that would make sense to you, because I'm now go to operas, and if I sit there and a singer crosses the stage for no apparent reason and sits down, and I just look at it and go, why would anyone do that? So that's how I look at operas. I look and see if what they're doing makes any sense to me. Would people actually do that?
And the way that the characters in Don Giovanni behave from the libretto, from the original score productions, etc., don't necessarily make sense to us today, because we have some different codes of behavior. But if we took all those people with their extreme behavior and put them in a nightclub setting, we say, oh yeah, that's how people behave.
Yeah, their behavior completely makes sense. The place I got stuck in Giovanni is I was doing my initial passing through and figuring out just where everyone was going to go, was Elvira's scene when she sings from her window and Giovanni and Leporello are down below and she's confusing who is where. And I looked at that and I thought, oh my God, there's no window, there's no garden, there's no arbor for anyone to hide behind. How are we going to do this?
Where's the arbor in this nightclub?
So I looked at the actual text of what they were saying, and I realized the entire thing made perfect sense as a cell phone conversation. Mm-hmm. The actual words made mm-hmm. perfect sense as a cell phone conversation.
And so kind of telegraphed.
And so I put Elvira in one part of the stage as though she were in her room, and I put Giovanni and Leporello in the bar listening on the same cell phone, you know, sort of, which is why they had to sort of be quiet so that she wouldn't overhear them laughing in the background.
Right.
And then the whole thing makes sense. And then I had these great singing actors. And as Elvira got more and more agitated with the information she was getting, the sight of this woman sitting at her dressing table screaming into the cell phone, which she's, it was hysterical.
Yeah.
That's the other thing. I always cast really great singing actors because I'm not a real director, so I'm definitely gonna need help. So I've done Giovanni. I did the Britain Midsummer Night's Dream last year. I did Faust this mm-hmm. past year.
And what did you do with the Faust?
The Faust, because we had our other production we do two productions each summer, and our other production had been Turandot, which was which is of course a maximal opera in every way. I did not conduct it, because anyone who's known me more than 5 minutes knows I am not the biggest Puccini fan, put very nicely. And so I turned Turandot over to one of my I have these great assistants, and they love that stuff. So I just said, you go, you have at your Turandot. And so since Turandot was a maximal production, Faust needed to be minimal. And I knew that I could basically stage Faust in kind of a modern setting in three platforms. And Faust, the opera started out with Faust in an assisted living facility before he transformed himself and becomes younger. And basically, the three platforms, one was sort of Mephistopheles' area, one was Faust's area, and one was Marguerite's area. And that's kind of where they functioned a lot of the time during the story. And then I used projections because in these days when you're trying to save money, this, you know, if you're out of money, projections are the way to go. Because honestly, the Turandot had lavish costumes and big sets and all those things. There just wasn't money to do another.
Right. Can't really do Turandot if you don't have a lot
exactly,
of that.
Exactly. That's exactly it. And Faust responded extremely well to this minimal production. And so we had a wonderful time staging it. Everyone had great fun and had a wonderful cast.
This coming season, which starts, I guess, officially in November for you, though you've already had a gala with Denise Graves.
That's
in
right.
October,
yes.
At the East Bay Symphony, Oakland East Bay Symphony. This coming season, you have everything from Beethoven's Ninth to a program where you've paired the Saint-Saëns Organ Symphony with Buster Keaton's The General, with an organist improvising
the organist
score,
doing his score.
Because
we're in an old movie house at the Paramount Theater in Oakland. And so I wanted to do something that really, plus it was the 20th anniversary of my being, you know, my 20th season. And so people were saying, you should do whatever you want this year. And I just love The General. It's one of the funniest movies ever
Absolutely.
Made. So I thought, we'll screen The General in the first half, and then we'll bring the orchestra on and play the Saint-Saëns Organ Symphony as the second half. So we're going to have great fun. And then we have an Armenian program,
right.
And we're ending with the Beethoven Ninth. But even the Beethoven Ninth is paired with The Deepest Desire, a Jake Heggie song cycle, which is great because it's a song cycle for mezzo. And in Beethoven Ninth, of course, you barely know the mezzo is on stage.
Right.
So it's
right.
great that
right.
she gets the other piece on the program.
This is another wonderful thing about the way you put these programs together, Michael, because even if you're not playing everything, you have a pretty encyclopedic knowledge of the repertoire, and you notice these kinds of connections that other people might just forget about or think aren't important, and then, hey, organ, Saint-Saëns, Buster Keaton, mezzo, Jake Heggie fits right into the Beethoven. How do you get a sense of that? And you have a good time doing it.
And I also have, I have to say, an audience that... one of my favorite things about my Oakland audience is they are the happiest when you're going the farthest out on a limb. And so they want to see the experimentation with the understanding that experiments, by definition, cannot always work. They very frequently, what we do works very well. Something's not going to work from time to time, but that's okay, because otherwise, if you only do what is sort of guaranteed, it's just a dull time for everybody.
With Michael Morgan, I don't know of any dull times. He is a conductor. He's, as you hear, a motivational speaker and an advisor to the industry. If only they would listen to him more. It's just a pleasure to have you back in Chicago. And who knows, maybe we'll be seeing you back on a more regular basis, depending upon how various things work out. But I think it would be a great thing for Chicago, and probably something, given the good times you've had here and the many friends and fans that you have here, something that you would enjoy as well. And we should really get out to Oakland and bring some microphones and tape recorders and see what's actually going on there on the ground, as they say.
It is truly a hoot. And yes, I'm really at the age now where what I do is really specific. So if people are interested in specifically what I do, then I'm happy to do it for them. If they want something different, please hire someone else.
Thank you so much, Michael. Music that you heard this evening from two of Michael Morgan's friends and mentors performing overtures to the operas of Michael's favorite composer, one Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart. You heard Daniel Barenboim and the Berlin Philharmonic, the overture to The Marriage of Figaro. You heard Sir George Schulte and orchestra, the overture to Così fan tutte, as well as the Shimmering Trio from said opera. We want to thank Matt DeStefano for making this program sound great. We want to thank Michael Morgan and the Chicago Sinfonietta for loaning Michael to us. Let us know what you thought about this or any of our other programs. Drop us a line at rentap, that's Patner spelled backwards, R-E-N-T-A-P at AOL.com. And be sure to visit us online, WFMT.com/oneword critical thinking, where you can experience the Critical Thinking Podcast. We want to thank our funders, Alphawood Foundation, and other friends of this program. Michael Morgan mentioned that he has been able to do a full production of Stephen Sondheim's Follies. We were going to bring you an excerpt from that, but I thought this little number with Elaine Stritch from the original 1970 Broadway cast of another Sondheim musical, Company, would be the right way to go out of this conversation. Listen carefully to the words and you'll see why. I'm Andrew Patner and we'll see you next week.
I'd like to propose a toast. Here's to the ladies who lunch. Everybody laugh. Lounging in their caftans and planning a brunch. On their own behalf. Off to the gym, then to a fitting, claiming their fat. And looking grim, 'cause they've been sitting, choosing a hat. Does anyone still wear a hat? I'll drink to that. Here's to the girls who stay smart. Aren't they a gas? Rushing to their classes in optical art, wishing it would pass. Another long, exhausting day, another $1,000, a matinee, a pinter play, perhaps a piece of Mahler's. I'll drink to that. And one for Mahler. Here's to the girls who play wife, aren't they too much? Keeping house but clutching a copy of Life just to keep in touch. The ones who follow the rules and meet themselves at the schools, too busy to know that they're fools. Aren't they a gem? I'll drink to them. Let's go. Girls who just watch, aren't they the best? When they get depressed, it's a bottle of scotch plus a little jest. Another chance to disapprove, another brilliant singer, another reason not to move, another vodka. I'll drink to that. So here's to the girls on the go. Everybody tries. Look into their eyes and you'll see what they know. Everybody dies. A toast to that invincible bunch. the dinosaur surviving the crunch. Let's hear it for the ladies who lunch. Everybody rock!